You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about the Catholic Church and the LGBT community after a Milwaukee priest's decision to come out to his congregation and the world. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss thinks Wisconsin needs a new prison. The John Doe probe is back in the news again. And a Wood County proposal would have meant big changes for the local Amish community there. Rob Mentzer joins us for a look at the top state news stories of the week. He's a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, good to have you back.
Hey, thanks. Happy Christmas.
And to you too, yeah.
Thank you.
Now let's start with Robin Voss. He's saying, first of all, before the prison part of this story, he's working on a proposal that if people reoffend while on court supervision, parole, they should go right back to prison. Do we know what prompted that?
Right, so these news items are the result of a year-end reviews or interviews that Voss granted, and you know this thing with sending people back to prisons who offend, it's consistent with this sort of general drift under the Republican legislature, which has been to increase penalties for things like drunken driving or domestic violence or other sorts of crimes. And yes, when you are increasing the penalties for crimes, it naturally raises the question of where do you put these people. And so yes, Voss acknowledged that right now the state prisons are over capacity, and there's going to be a commission to look at it. But what he sees is it's likely that Wisconsin's going to start building prisons.
Yeah, let's give a listen to Robin Voss.
We know that's not free, so we probably need to build a new prison. So we have to generate consensus around how do we take a system that's already at 130% of capacity and make sure that we have additional room to guarantee that people who commit a crime are locked up as they should be.
What's been the reaction from fellow Republican and Democratic lawmakers?
Well, so, you know, we see the same basic pattern. This is the case. There are a lot of county jails that are also over capacity. And it what tends to happen is building new jails or prisons tends to be rather unpopular. People do not like the sound of spending, you know, tens and hundreds of millions of dollars on these facilities. But also unpopular can be the public policy choices that would be required to not have to build the prison. So, you know, I just think it's important to understand that it is true the state's prisons are over capacity, but that is in part the result of public policy choices. I'm not an expert in this, but it's easy to look up the basic data, and what you see is Wisconsin really is in the middle of the pack in terms of U.S. states when it comes to the number of people incarcerated per capita. We were at number 26 in 2013 based on 2013 data, and so you can draw different conclusions from this, but you can also look and see that there are a whole lot of states that incarcerate fewer people per capita that don't have higher crime rates than Wisconsin. So you wonder if this is if there's another way out here.
We've heard just on this show from different lawmakers. We heard from a Republican who said, hey, let's start treating fewer juveniles as adults in the 17-year age range. We had a Democrat saying we need fewer people in prisons. In part, we can do that by making it so that you don't go back to prison for a non-criminal rules violation. We've got this from Robin Voss. Do you anticipate this, Rob, prison and prison reform being a big issue in 2018?
I think it's fair to say it's an issue that has the ability to create unusual coalitions. Conservatives and liberals can agree on some elements of at least the concept of criminal justice reform, but there's also a sort of populist side that is popular to appeal to sort of tough on crime policies. But we will hear more about it. It's a major issue that the state ought to confront.
We'll hear from a Wisconsin judge later in the show today who says we need to end the prison pipeline. Right now we're talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin. Look at some of the top stories of the week in Wisconsin news. And then the Government Accountability Board and the John Doe investigations, they're back in the news with calls for some investigations. What is going on, Rob?
Sure. This is continuing fallout from the Attorney General's investigation into the leak of these John Doe investigations into campaign activities of Governor Scott Walker and some Republican legislators. Basically, what happened is earlier this month, the Attorney General released his report on this investigation. It did not include any criminal charges against anyone, but it did include a number of attacks on the former Government Accountability Board, which has since been dissolved. And so this news this week is, sort of these legislators getting fired up about what was in that report and asking for a broader investigation into that defunct agency.
And there are people who are on the staff at the GAB, the Government Accountability Board, who are now on the successor agencies, the Elections Commission and the Ethics Commission.
Right.
And we're hearing calls from Republican legislative leaders that they should step down or will step them down, in effect, at their confirmations next year.
Right, right. And yeah, and just today, I mean, it was in the newscast at the top of the hour, one of them, Brian Bell, is saying he wants to, please, investigate me. I he's calling for an investigation to clear his own name, which also is a way of, the subtext there is he is not stepping down. So this may not be the last time we discuss this issue either.
And Republicans are saying, okay, we have this investigation went too far. It scooped up too many emails. It didn't protect data of people being investigated very well or at all because a lot of this was leaked. Democrats are saying, hold on, these things investigated Republicans, and now Republicans are punishing the investigators. So this is going to be probably a partisan issue too.
Right. I mean, it's worth taking a step back and looking at what has happened in the years since the John Doe probe, which indeed, I mean, the John Doe probe went on for years. There were multiple parts of the probe, and it sort of was continually expanding its scope. And that's the argument you laid out some of the arguments about the ways that its handling may have been inappropriate. But since it was shut down in 2015 by the Supreme Court, Republicans in Wisconsin have broken up the Government Accountability Board. It does not exist anymore. They have changed laws to limit John Doe investigations into political leaders, so that can't happen in Wisconsin anymore. They launched a criminal investigation into these leaks and now pressing for resignations from the Ethics Committee. So I'll just say to note exactly how far they have gone in their response to these investigations. The answer is very far, with some very big and sweeping changes.
Well, we'll be talking about this for weeks to come. I want to visit Wood County now, a story you've been watching there, Rob. Local officials proposed an ordinance aimed, they said, at making the roads safer, but it would have put some restrictions and regulations on Amish people in the area. What would have changed?
Right. This was voted down Tuesday, but not before a large bit of controversy in central Wisconsin. So the ordinance would have required Amish buggies to have windshields and seat belts and car seats for children, among actually a number of other requirements. Buggy drivers also would have had to have state driver's licenses or pass a test. And so the reality was, at least one expert that we interviewed here said that this would have likely had the effect of driving Amish communities out of where they live in Wood County. And so there was really quite a backlash in response to that, just that the ordinance, which responds to a real thing. There have been a number of traffic deaths in central Wisconsin in cases of Amish buggy crashes. But I think the public's response was that this went too far and was to the point of being unfairly targeting of this minority community. And so it didn't get a vote. It's not going to happen.
Is there a thought that they'll revisit and maybe have a more limited series of changes?
So by the end, at least some of the people who had been advocating for the policies had retreated to the point of saying maybe we should just require some better lights on the back of Amish buggies, which does seem reasonable. I mean, again, there have been 9 traffic deaths since 2009. That's not a trivial number of deaths. So it's not that there's no issue, but maybe something on the scale of like lights might be a little bit more better received. We'll see.
Want to check out one more fun story. We had Jen Barney on the show a while back, a baker from Stoddard, Wisconsin. She since then has won the Food Network Holiday Baking Championship. Here's a listen to her talking about her Wisconsin roots.
I was always true to myself throughout the whole thing. I am a Midwesterner. You could tell who I was with my plates, and I think that really helped me out.
So Wisconsin wins this holiday baking title, Rob.
Yeah, that's great. Congratulations, Jen Barney. I have not watched this holiday baking championship, but I can say it is like my wife's favorite genre of television show. So I feel like maybe yet this holiday season we might get a viewing in.
And does this inspire the making of holiday treats in your household?
Sure. Her biggest, she's on a campaign to try to convince our 6-year-old son that he should become a pastry chef when he grows up. And we'll send him to the pastry chef school and then get to eat all of his delicious desserts. So I can report back in 20 years whether that worked out.
It's a noble calling. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Rob Metzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. We'll take a look at the year in Wisconsin news with him on Tuesday. First, attendees of St. Bernadette Parish of Milwaukee gave a standing ovation to their priest, Father Greiton, on Sunday after he came out to them as gay. On Monday, it was made public to the rest of the world in his column in the National Catholic Reporter. Here's Father Greiton in a recent interview with NBC.
For me now is I get to live a life that's open. It is honest and it's full of integrity, and that's what's most important to me.
Joining us now to talk about the church and the LGBT community is Father James Martin. Father Martin is a Jesuit priest, editor for America Magazine, and the author of Building the Bridge: How the Catholic Church and the LGBT community can enter into a relationship of respect, compassion, and sensitivity. Father Martin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, my pleasure.
Well, this is not something we see happen every day. How significant is this?
It's highly significant. There are only a handful of priests who are out in that way, that is, you know, publicly and to the entire parish. The other significant thing is that Archbishop Lestecky, who I really praise for his compassion, supported this priest. So that's also a very significant move.
And was that a surprise to you that the Archbishop spoke out? Here's some of what he said. He said, Father Greiton's story reminds us each of God's call to continue to grow in understanding and to live holy, chaste lives.
I think it's fantastic. You know, he is just admitting people already know, which is that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of hardworking gay priests who are celibate, you know, who maintain their promises of celibacy and, you know, who are beloved by their parishes. So I thought it was a very bold move by both Father Greiton and also Archbishop Lestecky.
And then, as we heard in the setup there, his parish had given him a standing ovation, seemed to really respect this decision. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, and why wouldn't they? They know him as a good priest, and I would imagine some people might have suspected or might have known. And so, you know, they are supporting him in his totality. That is part of who he is. It's not the only part, but you know, that's a significant part of his life, and I think it's great that they're welcoming him and that he's being open and truthful about it.
A lot. I think there are Catholics out there who will say, wait, what's going on? This is a lifestyle, a mentality that is against many of the teachings of the church.
It is against zero teachings of the church because he's celibate and chaste, and his lifestyle is that of chastity and devoting himself to the church. So it is not a sin to be gay, you know, in the Catholic eyes. And Father Greiton is basically doing exactly what the Catechism says, which is living a life of chastity.
We've seen cases elsewhere in the Catholic Church where people were censured or relieved of their duties because of not coming out as gay specifically, but for activism or working with gay advocacy groups. Has that happened often?
No, not too often. You know, I think what's sad is that there are people who are fired from their jobs for being in same-sex marriages. And, you know, the sexual morality of LGBT people is policed in a way that simply does not happen for straight people. I mean, we don't fire all people who are divorced or, you know, who are living together before being married. It's a kind of focus on LGBT people in a way that I think is unjust.
Now, in his column that we mentioned from the National Catholic Reporter, Father Greiton painted a bleak picture of his years in seminary and the reaction to him bringing up these issues, maybe to mentors there. Do you think things need to change at that training level?
Absolutely, because look, you have someone like Father Greiton who is a good priest and who is beloved, and he shows, you know, as many other priests do, that it is possible to be gay, celibate, and a good Catholic priest. And so, you know, why wouldn't you want people who feel called to God by God to this way of life, you know, even if they're gay?
I think some of the reaction I've seen out there to this issue is people not separating gay and the celibacy angle of this, assuming that identifying as gay implies the presence of a sexual behavior.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I've never understood why that's the case. I mean, you know, the irony is that the Catechism asks gay people to be chaste, and here's someone who's being chaste, and people seem to not be able to even deal with that. So, you know, I mean, gay people are able to be chaste and celibate as much as straight people are, and they're able to be good priests just as much as straight priests are.
We're talking to Father James Martin. He's the author of the book, Building the Bridge, How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. Earlier this week, actually on Sunday, a priest in Milwaukee came out to his congregation and then to the world in an article in the National Catholic Reporter. Can you talk about where the Vatican is on the issue of someone like Father Greiton coming out as gay?
That's a good question. Now, the Vatican has a document that said that men with deep-seated homosexual tendencies should not be admitted to seminaries or the priesthood. But different bishops interpret that in different ways. Some bishops say that means no gays. Some bishops say that it means gays who can't be celibate. Some bishops say that it means that someone for whom being gay is their only sort of identity or their primary identity. But by the same token, you know, Pope Francis, when asked specifically about gay priests, uttered his five most famous words, "Who am I to judge?" That famous quote is specifically about gay priests, and so we have it from the top that he is okay with gay priests.
Some people might look at this within the Catholic Church, maybe women in the Catholic Church, and think, what about us? Why can't we be in a role comparable to that of priest?
Yeah, I think a lot of women would do that. I think the two issues are rather separate. But yeah, there are a lot of women who are interested in being priests, and there are a lot of Catholics who are in favor of that.
I've seen people try to estimate how many gay priests there might be out there in the Catholic Church, and seeing a huge range of numbers. Do you have any sense of how common this might be?
Yeah, I know many gay Catholic priests. I would say 30 to 40%, but really, you know, it's, as you pointed out, it's very anecdotal because I think the Church is afraid to do a survey because they're afraid of how many priests would identify as gay. But I think it's most Catholics, I think, who are intelligent and thoughtful already know this. It shouldn't be a surprise to most intelligent and thoughtful Catholics.
And this has taken a long time for Father Greiton to do. I mean, he's been in the priesthood for 25 years, I think it was. Even if the Vatican were to, if the Church were to want to survey people, would priests be willing to come forward?
Well, another good question. One of the reasons that priests do not come forward is because their bishop or their religious superior, if they're in a religious order, you know, is against it. Or they may simply be private people. It's not for everybody to be out like that. But I think, you know, Jesus says the truth sets us free, and it's a gift. The truth is a gift to the Church when someone like Father Greiton exercises it.
Yeah, and in his article, Father Greiton talked about the feeling of living a lie for all of those years of suppressing the truth. Can you talk about the kind of conflict that a priest might face for years, maybe their whole lives?
Well, sure, and it's the same kind of conflict that any LGBT person faces in being secret. I think one of the great things about being open like that is that he now provides a role model of, you know, just a normal, healthy person to, for example, like a gay boy, you know, who might be 13 or 14 or 15 and thinking, you know, the Church hates me. And, you know, here finally is this priest who can say, you know, I'm like you, and, you know, the Church doesn't hate you, and let me talk about what the way it was for me. So I think one of the great benefits of these kinds of, revelations is that it gives so much hope to LGBT youth in the Church and beyond.
This is happening in the United States. The Catholic Church, of course, is a global organization. Are we in a similar position in other countries around the world, or would it be more difficult even for a priest to come out?
Well, I think in Western Europe, it would be perhaps as easy, but certainly in other parts of the world, sub-Saharan Africa, different parts of Asia, India, I think it would be almost unthinkable. And, you know, we have to look at how LGBT people are treated in those countries for an indication of how that would go over, which is not very well.
I think people think of the Catholic Church as kind of a monolith, that there's one policy from the top down and everybody observes it. We're hearing a lot of variation here. That said, do you think that there could be a more clear message from the top of the church?
I think there should be. You know, Pope Francis, as I said, who am I to judge? But I think that the church is invited to see people like Father Greiton as good and holy and hardworking members, you know, of the priesthood and, you know, members of the church in full standing. And so, you know, why shouldn't they be welcomed into the church? And why shouldn't someone who's holy and hardworking be not only accepted but celebrated? And so, absolutely, I think that the church needs to look at this very seriously and really needs to sort of move ahead and just accept what is already reality.
Having talked to priests who are gay in the course of your work and your book, of course, do you think that Father Greiton coming out so publicly and writing about it might lead others to follow his lead?
I do, and I think what is just as significant, you know, as I mentioned, is Archbishop Listecki. The idea that, you know, Father Greiton is doing it with Archbishop's permission and that he supports him, and that he issued that very compassionate statement. I hope they do, and I hope it helps. And I think, again, the group that I think would help the most are LGBT parishioners, especially LGBT youth, who can look at someone, you know, in the pulpit, you know, helping people and living a good pastoral life and saying, you know, I can see someone who is an adult Catholic and who has embraced the faith, who is like me and who seems holy and who seems appealing. So I think it would be a great sort of charitable step forward if people were to do that.
Father Martin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Father James Martin is a Jesuit priest, editor of America magazine, and author of Building a Bridge, a book on the Catholic Church and the LGBT community. He joined us to talk about the Milwaukee priest who came out to his congregation over the weekend. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin judge who says we need to do more to keep young people out of the prison pipeline. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday morning after 8, Erica Janik hosts a Wisconsin Life holiday special. It's a celebration of holiday food, family traditions, and the joys of winter in Wisconsin. That's Monday morning after 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, since taking the bench over a year ago, Dane County Circuit Court Judge Everett Mitchell has described himself as a people's judge. In a new column, he's speaking out about using compassion and patience in his role to stop what he calls the prison pipeline. He's also a pastor of Christ the Solid Rock Baptist Church on Madison's east side. Judge Mitchell, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio.
Thank you all so much for having me.
Well, let's talk about the prison pipeline. What do you mean by that?
So what I'm trying to really articulate is that at least in Dane County, and I suspect otherwise, what we have is a pipeline from what I call child welfare to juvenile delinquency to adult prison pipeline. So it is a continuation of taking like traumatized young people who have experienced the removal because of parental abuse or other kinds of things in which they have not had the kind of care that they needed. And then they get processed through these continual systems of being moved around the state, eventually ended up in juvenile delinquency courts, and then ultimately it is almost like a true pathway that they end up in adult incarceration.
And you wrote that your first days on the bench left you feeling kind of frustrated about this. What were you seeing? What were you feeling as these kids came into your court?
Well, one, you would see very traumatized children. You would see young women who had been victims of sex trafficking. You would see young men who had grown up in all kinds of, you know, isolated situations, no mother, no father, had been through multiple systems and ended up in the juvenile delinquency system and trying to figure out what do you do with a child that nobody wants and has no home to go to. And in many ways, that is not the systems that many of us think about. Many of us come from, you know, places where you at least have someone who will answer the phone while you're in court. But a lot of these children didn't even they came to court alone by themselves. No grandmother, no father, no aunt, uncle, brother, sister. They were just alone. And so that was gut-wrenching because you're asking yourself, how are these children going to be able to ever direct themselves in a positive way if they don't have anyone in their lives to do so?
And I imagine over the course of a week or a month, you might see some of those kids at a younger age, and then you might be seeing the adults making their way to prison now and looking back and saying, well, that's that kid is that grown up in a few years.
Yeah, you know, my work with Madison Area Urban Ministry, working with men and women who are returning from prisons, all of them had the same trauma narratives that I'm seeing in these young people. And so that's why I'm being very attentive to, you know, what I do in court, what I say, how I say it, because I don't want to feed that trauma narrative. I don't want to make it worse. If anything, I want to make it better.
So how do you start to talk to these kids in your court and work with them to get them out of that pipeline?
Well, the first thing we had to do was I had to push for the removal of handcuffs off the kids. You know, at that time, there was a kind of blanket policy that you would bring children who were in detention with handcuffs. And, you know, the more the studies tell us about trauma and the ACE scores, adverse childhood experiences, it tells you you can't just, you know, place those children in handcuffs like that. And so that was one act that I, you know, that really helped the kids feel safer, that when they come into court that they can, you know, don't have to come in there feeling like, you know, an adult criminal.
How old are we talking about here coming in handcuffs?
Well, you know, in Wisconsin, you can start at the age of 10 years old. So I think I saw the youngest was like 11. And 11 years old.
Do you feel like, you know, when a kid is coming into the court in handcuffs at age 11, there's a sense that, yeah, we've already given up on you?
I think that's the message that they receive, is that we've already given up on them.
And you, in your writing, you've talked about trying to bring the kids in on their own plan, and not just, here's what the court is going to do for or to you, but how can you work with us? What kind of things do you talk to kids about?
You talk about their entire life. So you talk about what do they need to manage their anger? What do they need for school? What do they need in order to make sure that they don't, you know, steal cars or go back into those, you know, go back into that criminal behavior? A lot of the stuff that these children do is criminal damage to property or disorderly conduct because, you know, they act out. And when they act out in various settings, that's what gets them the first trigger. So we're trying to ask them, what do you need in order to not get angry and not get so upset in those settings? And they are creative. I mean, the kids come up with all kinds of stuff from like, give me a fidget, or just let me go play basketball, or just, you know, give me just a few minutes to gather my thoughts. And those ideas have really led to a reshaping of how I really approach dealing with our young people.
We're talking to Dane County Circuit Court Judge Everett Mitchell. He says we need to treat kids with more compassion and keep them out of a prison pipeline. And we're talking about how he tries to do that. So, I mean, with a kid, there's so many different things going on. The trauma you talked about, maybe neglect, no adult that they can look to support them or even call from a courtroom. It seems like there'd be so many different things that need to happen to help them. What, as a judge, do you think there are those resources out there for them?
Well, one of the reasons I'm, you know, I accept interviews like this and other places is because I don't think people talk about the child welfare system enough. You know, until I took the bench, I really didn't understand it. And most people, if you were to ask them casually about it, they don't understand it. And if we're going to be serious about, you know, reducing disparities and, you know, changing the narrative as relates to, you know, Wisconsin being the kind of the worst in disparities related to incarceration, we really do have to do a deeper dive into the child welfare system. And I suspect that if it's that way in Dane County, then other pockets, you know, whether it's in Milwaukee or Kenosha, Racine, up north, you know, we'll find similar patterns. And I really do want us to get ahead of this because, you know, with the opioid epidemic, I'm seeing a number of children who are born to who are born with mothers and fathers who are addicted, and they're losing, you know, parents are passing away. And with these children who are born addicted to these drugs. So I'm really concerned about making sure that we do, we have more transparent and deeper education around what child welfare looks like.
We've heard talk about the idea of more trauma-informed care for people often in this kind of situation. The First Lady of Wisconsin, Tonette Walker, has been talking this up around the state. Are you encouraged by hearing things like that?
Yeah, but I want them to... I'm glad they have trauma-informed care. What I want them to take the next step is trauma-informed practices and let the practices that we do that engage people who have dealt with trauma, make sure our practices reflect what is the best that we're looking for as it relates to their trauma.
when you're a judge, I mean, you're just getting a real snapshot of a kid's life here. I mean, they're in front of you in a courtroom for, I don't know, half an hour, I'm guessing.
But the thing is, as a juvenile judge, you get way more information. It's not adult court. Adult court, you really do get a snapshot. But in juvenile, I get their entire history. So I know what they have been through. I know where a foster home they've been with. I know how many, what kind of cases have brought them before the court, all the removals. I get all of that history. So while, and then, you know, I choose how much time I want to spend with them. So if it's a meaningful conversation, then I can budget enough time for us to have meaningful conversations. And, you know, 35 minutes, an hour in the life of a teenager, if they talk to you, then you understand that that is a crucial and beneficial time.
And you mentioned foster homes, and it seems like that's got to be an important part of the story here. Do we have enough foster parents in Wisconsin? Are they getting the training, the help they need?
I think the foster parents do a wonderful job, and we have wonderful caretakers in our community, and we're lucky for that. I think what we don't have are options like group homes in Dane County. So we have no group homes in Dane County. So that means that judges are limited in where we can place children who have these trauma-related needs. And so you get left with options or either up north or out of state, or Lincoln Hills becomes a default location when you don't have a place to put a child that doesn't have a home to go to.
We've heard a lot of stories and talked on the show a lot about Lincoln Hills, the youth correctional facility. We've heard from judges in Milwaukee County that they're reluctant to send kids up there because of stories of abuse and neglect, safety issues for the residents there and for staff. I mean, do you hesitate before sending kids up there?
I think you have to do a balancing test. You know, when I went, when I took the bench, I took my staff up to Lincoln Hills so we could see it and visit. And when I saw some of the places inside Lincoln Hills, you know, there were a lot of things that concerned me. There were a lot of things that concerned me about some of the young men and education. And what I try to do to the young men and women who come to my court is say, you know, I'm not going to place you at Lincoln Hills. You're going to go to Lincoln Hills, and you're going to make the choice to do so. Because my preference is to work to get you the resources you need so that you never have to go to a place like Lincoln Hills. And if they're making progress, if they happen to be at Lincoln Hills and they're making progress, I'll bring them back home and we'll put them on county supervision just so they can, you know, get back into the rhythm of being a teenager, go to prom, you know, go to basketball games, get on the basketball team, because I really value education, because I believe a lot of these children without access to education, they will never be successful.
I imagine one goal, when it's possible, is to get a kid with a family member, a parent, a grandparent, whatever. Is there help out there for those situations where, because of addiction, say, that's not an option today, but maybe it is in a year?
I think that's what we're trying to gather more information. I just don't see we have enough of that in our communities. We have a lot of resources here. The question is whether or not our resources are geared toward addressing that the deep levels of trauma and pain, and really giving them the continual culturally diverse experiences and treatment providers that they need so they can feel safe and begin to work through those levels of trauma.
Dane County Circuit Court Judge Everett Mitchell is in our studio with us now to talk about how he's working to end the prison pipeline in Wisconsin. Kids dealing with trauma in their lives may be entering in a path that ends up in prison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are there changes you want to see in Wisconsin's court system? Is sentencing, you think, too tough or not tough enough when it comes to kids? Have you worked with this? Has this been a part of your life? Were you as a kid in the legal system, the correctional system, or do you work with kids who are maybe on that path? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time in just a couple minutes. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about Wisconsin's prison pipeline. Judge Everett Mitchell is with us in the studio. He's a Dane County Circuit Court judge. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your comments, maybe your experiences. Have you had an experience with Wisconsin's criminal justice system, maybe as a youth or a parent? What do you think about this call for a compassionate approach, trying to figure out, help solve problems of trauma and related issues with kids to keep them out of prison in the long run? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to our callers now. Travis is with us in Madison. Travis, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to tell us about Travis?
So I work at a school called the GROW Academy, which is a Department of Juvenile Corrections facility. It's a residential program for teenage boys. And it's a sort of agricultural science-based curriculum. I run garden programming, so right now we're doing a lot of indoor gardening. I just wanted your guest to comment on the GROW Academy, if he's familiar, or programs like the GROW Academy that can help reduce this school-to-prison pipeline problem.
Travis, thanks for the call. Judge Mitchell?
Yeah, I think Travis has a couple of my kids. I've had a couple of my kids because I think the GROW Academy provides a different, I mean, woodworking, as you talked about, agricultural. I mean, they're doing some very fantastic ways in which get kids embodied and doing different ways in which getting back in nature. And what he's talking about is true. Like, we need more GROW Academies to give kids different types of experiences so that we don't have to necessarily send them, incarcerate them. We can re-educate them with new skills, new talents, new relationships. When I go out to the graduations of the young men that I have in my court, I mean, it's fantastic to see these kids who come from urban places like Chicago talking about the urban farm, you know, the farming, and they got this water aquifers, and they're growing, you know, celery and all these different things with fish and aquaponics. So we just need more options like that so that these children can be reeducated in a different way.
And it took some creative thinking probably for someone to start that program.
It was. I mean, it was very intuitive. And I think that's what the best of Wisconsin has to offer, all of the great resources and values and systems that we have within our communities. If we can use those things to kind of marshal a different path for these children, we will find them able to respond. Because some of these young men I saw respond in ways that, you know, the nurturing in that space really did offer them a different path, and they changed dramatically because of that expectation.
Travis, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Scott on the line in Nisida. Scott, hi.
Hey, I'm calling back there in 1981. I was 14 years old. I went to Lincoln Hills as party to a crime of armed robbery that another guy did. They put me in an M cottage right away. I ended up staying there until I was 18 and a half. I escaped three different times. The fence is actually up because of me. The thing is, Lincoln Hills, now that I'm older, the thing that it led up to, I got, after 4 years in Lincoln, I got out, and I was out a year, and I was in prison for murder for 25 years. So after 16 years, I've now been out for 20 years, and I know now, looking back, how much Lincoln could have helped me if I would have followed what they were trying to do. I was rebelling against it. I can see it now. And when they talk about closing Lincoln, I think that's just a horrible thing. It needs to be readjusted to go back to the kind of goals and the kind of people they had working there when I was there. And it could be dramatically helpful. I can tell you, out of 4 years in Lincoln Hills, the only people that I saw in prison, and I was in all of them, was three. Nobody else in Lincoln, while I was there, ended up in the adult system that I saw. So they were doing something right.
Scott, thanks for the call. And Lincoln Hills has changed since he was there. It was merged with the Ethan Allen, I think, when that was closed. So maybe a different scene there now. But are there lessons you think we could take and apply at a facility like Lincoln Hills that might keep people from ending up in adult prison?
Well, I think Scott is bringing up a very important point, depending on where he's from. I mean, it's local resources. So I think, you know, having children 2, 3, 4 hours away from their primary families, their mothers can't get to them. There are other things that you need to have in place so that these children still stay connected to their communities for longer than so that, you know, we're making some changes, and I'm hopeful that moving forward, we'll have more changes.
Scott, thanks for that call. We're talking to Everett Mitchell. He's a Dane County Circuit Court judge. He says we need to do more to help keep kids facing trouble, kids who end up in the court system from ending up on a prison pipeline. Back to our calls now at 800-642-1234. Lori is with us in Madison. Lori, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Lori?
I wanted to say that I used to work at Ethan Allen School for Boys, and that was about 35 years ago. Mm-hmm. I honestly don't see much change since that time. I am not a supportive person of the penal system. I believe that we could deal with kids that are in trouble in smaller units, residential treatment programs, programs that are close to families and that involve the families. When I worked at Wales, there were two psychologists for hundreds of residents. There was not treatment. It was penal. It was punishment. And the what they called youth counselors were actually prison guards. They were not trained in counseling. They were guards. They were just called a different name because they work with young people.
Lori, thanks a lot for that call. Two issues there. She brings up mental health care. Mm-hmm. Not much of it she saw back in that time. And she says smaller facilities would work better.
Yeah, the biggest issues that we still see is the access to, you know, quality mental health treatment for a lot of them, because they need real-time quality health. And not just psychiatrists who prescribe medicine, but people who can actually walk these children through a level of trauma that they need. And that's why we always talk about bringing them closer to their home environments, because, you know, in Dane County, if we had to send a kid away, you basically send them away from a rich place that has a lot of access to diverse therapeutic environments that could really be helpful to them.
Thanks a lot for that call, Lori. We'll go next to Mary on the line in Cedarburg. Mary, hi.
Hi. Listen, I was a foster parent starting in 2000, and I have a great story. My daughter is now in her last year of college, going to be a social worker, but we could only adopt her until she was 18 and could make the choice herself. I want to know what's being done about termination of parental rights, because during her whole in and out of the foster care system, that was never an option.
Mary,
so what
thanks.
What can a judge do about it?
Mary, thanks for that call. So you can't adopt a kid unless their parents terminate their parental rights. And it sounds like in this case, she was a foster parent, but the foster child's birth parents presumably wouldn't sign off on that.
Yeah, it's not something they voluntarily consent to. They can voluntarily consent to terminate their rights. Most of the times, if a child has been out of home for 15 out of 22 months, that is normally a trigger where they could move to terminate a parental rights. But if the parent is trying to make progress on what they call conditions of return, as long as they're making progress, then typically counties and states try not to immediately move toward that. There's a whole lot of disagreement about what does it mean and how often you should be terminating parental rights based on the age of a child. But basically, for mostly, that's what we are looking for, to see if the parent is going to move toward any kind of progress before, you know, counties file for terminate those parental rights.
Mary, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Anne on the line in Madison. Anne, briefly, we're just about out of time. What did you want to bring up?
Hi, I'm not able to be a foster parent, but I like to volunteer and help people. What kind of things could I do to help kids in the foster system?
Well, I think one of the things you could do is, you know, support what I always call like book drives and support places that deal with children. So there are a lot of organizations that do deal with children. I love Madison Area Urban Ministry is one organization that I know works with parents who works with children who have a parent that's incarcerated. You can volunteer to work with those children when they go to Tichita to visit their mothers. You know, those little activities like that, being present in those spaces, really do assist in very powerful ways.
Thanks for the call, Ann. And Judge Mitchell, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That was Dane County Judge Everett Mitchell. We've been talking about Wisconsin's prison pipeline and efforts to keep kids who end up in the legal system as kids from ending up in prison as adults.